Thank you. That's a tough act to follow, John. This is going to be on a very small part of what John talked about in his talk, but trying to estimate the components of evapotranspiration with remote sensing and in principle on using UAV imagery. So the point here is that, you know, for many crops and many landscapes, the land surface is partially vegetated. And particularly for row crops, there are many areas in the world now facing water shortage issues. And so there's a major emphasis now on trying to produce as much or utilize water as much for the crop only and not have it lost by the soil. So you maximize the biomass and yield with whatever water you provide to that vegetation. Now, what we know is that in these partially vegetated surfaces, there's a temperature signal that at times can be strongly dominated by the background soil. And this indicates that the energy balance for both the soil and canopy systems needs to be explicitly treated if you're going to use land surface temperature to quantify energy exchange and water use. So that's what necessitates the development of the what we call the two-source modeling approach, where we're trying to estimate the transport through the resistances from the soil surface. So what we're trying to do is estimate the transport from the soil surface and the resistance associated with that and the canopy. These two, the soil resistance from the aerodynamic soil resistance from the soil and that of the canopy are going to differ, can differ significantly for a landscape. And so what was developed with collaboration with John and others has been the two-source energy balance model. And basically, given the limited time, I can't really go through the details of the model, but basically there's an explicit treatment of the soil and canopy systems and the exchange through these aerodynamic resistances from the canopy and soil. And the temperature that you observe from an airborne or satellite system is partitioned between the soil and canopy based on the fractional cover estimated from remote sensing. Then there's this temperature constraint from both the soil and canopy help define the exchange of sensible heat and net radiation and soil heat from the soil surface. And a key closure to those set of equations is the assumption of the latent heat flux from the canopy. And several different formulations have been developed over time. The original was a Priestley-Taylor approximation for evaporation from the canopy. There's been a Penman-Montese and a light use efficiency approach as well. Now, one thing that I haven't pointed out here is that if you could actually determine the canopy and soil temperatures from high enough resolution, you would then skip the step of having to make this assumption, or at least an initial assumption of what the canopy evaporation is. And I'll come back to that in this analysis. So the validation of the two-source model since the development in the mid-1990s has continued for the last virtually 20 years. I can't believe it's been 20 years, but it has. And it's covered a range of different landscapes from agricultural to natural vegetated landscapes, forests, and irrigated. Most recently, we've been working in irrigated vineyards and orchards, and I'll describe a little bit about that work. But the validation is only on those total fluxes. In other words, the surface energy balance, the net radiation, soil heat flux, and the total sensible and latent heat fluxes. The problem is there isn't as much information or measurements about the component fluxes. What is the soil evaporation and what is the canopy transpiration contribution? And how do you, and then utilizing those two component measurements to test whether the model can partition properly the soil and canopy fluxes. So here I just give a few brief examples of some recent work on testing the two-source model with E and T evaporation and transpiration observations. This is an example from some irrigated maize in China where they actually had soil and canopy temperature measurements that they fed into the two-source model. So as I mentioned, there is no, you don't need this latent heat flux of the canopy parameterization to initialize and reach a solution. You can actually use those canopy and soil temperatures in the two-source model formulation to estimate the sensible heat flux from the canopy, and then from the energy balance of the canopy, determine the latent heat flux. And you can see for the maize system, it does a pretty good job. Here the blue and red are, blue is the observed ratio of the transpiration over the total latent heat flux, and the red is the estimated. And the same here, the soil is the estimated here with the blue triangles, and the black is the observed soil evaporation over total. And this is using stable oxygen and hydrogen isotope techniques. So there exist techniques, but there's a lot of issues involved in deriving those component fluxes. Here's an example over irrigated cotton. This was part of the Barex project in Bushland, Texas. Paul Calazzi here showed a comparison between a Penman-Monteith version of the two-source model where a solution is reached running a Penman-Monteith version versus using the soil and canopy temperature measurements. And you can see here that now this is compared to microlysimetry and sap flow measurements in the irrigated cotton field. This actually does, the Penman-Monteith approach actually does a little bit better job here in, as far as a reduced bias between the estimated plant transpiration or observed plant transpiration and the soil evaporation compared to the using the actual temperatures. There's, of course, always an issue is, you know, what's the bias in those canopy and soil temperatures? They could come from the view angle of the sensor, what it's actually seeing on the ground, and so there's some issues related to that I'll bring up again as I go through this talk. There'll be a talk later this morning on a drip irrigated vineyard in Israel. Delia Kuhl will be showing some results of her work with data from this particular vineyard. What I want to emphasize here is that there's issues that the formulations within the two-source model may need to be modified for certain canopies. In this case, with these widely spaced row and vineyard systems and large deviations in temperatures between shaded and unshaded portions of the inter-row system versus the canopy, and wind flow properties that can be quite unique for vineyard-type structures, this study utilized measurements in the inter-row and below the vineyard drip irrigated system, microlysimeter measurements and energy balance estimates to formulate that the resistance formula for the soil in below the canopy needed to be modified to get good agreement. So there's a lot of work that still needs to be done in understanding how you define these resistances inside the canopy. So as I just mentioned, in a vineyard, there's some extreme conditions that you get with partial canopies, both in wind flow and radiation divergence, that call for some complexities that you may need to deal with. This is a photo of a site in near Lodi, California, part of the GrapeX project, where we're looking at energy and water exchange in a vineyard. And it's also complicated by having a cover crop. So you actually have a three-source system now. You have a cover crop, you have a bare soil area where there's drip irrigation, and then you have the vine system itself, trellis system. So you can So in one sense, it's a uniform system as far as how it's laid out, with evenly spaced but widely spaced rows. Here are almost 3.5 meters, a cover crop area that's about 2 meters wide, but then you have this bare soil region, which is a little over 0.5 meter. Then you have where the vines actually grow in this lower and upper cordon system. And so it's in one sense it's organized, but in another sense it's still quite complex. And over the course of a season, you get variations in what goes on in that vineyard, both from a management standpoint, when they treat the surface, they prune the vines, they mow the cover crop, and so you get variations in contributions of evapotranspiration from the cover crop, the soil evaporation, and then transpiration from the vines themselves, and variations over the course of a season on how the biomass changes in the vine system. So one of the things we've been looking at is developing or utilizing formulas that treat variation in the canopy density, or where the biomass actually is in the canopy, and how that modifies the wind profile. This is an example of a recent development by Bill Mossman on formulations of wind profile inside a canopy airspace based on foliage density. His development is actually for fire in forests, trying to model the transport of fire as it moves through a forest floor, but this same formulations are very useful in understanding what might be happening in vineyards and how the wind profile gets affected. In this case here, there's a cover crop, so you see you have this distribution here for the vineyard, for the vines themselves, and then a cover crop here causes another spike in the vegetation biomass, which could affect the profile. And then you have a condition here where the vines are actually growing down lower in the canopy, affecting the distribution, and here again an effect on the profile. Not so dramatic in the results here, at least from some of our initial work. There's also the issue of the radiation divergence in the canopy. And these are some measurements made with radiation sensors on the floor there with a board spaced along here. And then here's a picture, and you can see there's a whole lot of variability over time of where radiation penetrates. And, you know, even here, looking at this photo, you can see, well, if the board is here, it's in the sunlight. Well, if the board were over here, it'd be in the shade. So it makes it even complicated trying to measure the average radiation divergence in the canopy. And just here are just some examples of the mean estimated, or measured, I should say, versus above the top, above the canopy radiation. And you could see, you know, even when you average over multiple sites here, you still see a lot of spikiness in the measurements themselves, just due to this varying vegetation cover condition and sunlit and shaded periods. But that's the kind of data you have to work with when you're trying to do some validation of models. And this is just an example of the work we're doing on trying to validate different radiation divergence type models inside the canopy and comparing that to what we observe from the measurements. Each of these has a different level of complexity and inputs requirements. And it just shows you the level of scatter you might get between the measurements that you can take and the modeling approaches. But it certainly points to some of these models here with higher complexity do a better job than some of the original formulations that don't include row orientation or where the significant amount of biomass is in the profile. So What does this lead to? Well, in this example, what I'm going to show is here what we have are, so we have two vineyard sites where we have tower measurements of ET, and we modified the wind profiles and the radiation divergence using some of these newer formulations based on what we observed in the field and what we developed modeling approaches. And the blue is the observations of total ET, and the red and the black symbols represent two different forms of the two-source model, one with the original wind profile formulation that was used in the model, and the other is with the red being the Mossman derived profile. And you can see they more or less give similar results, although Mossman's profile does a better job earlier in the season when we had cover crop conditions in here. It's a little bit higher than the measurements here, but it just points to some of these adaptions to the model that may be quite important in certain periods of time during the life cycle of the vineyard and the growth cycle of the vineyard. Here are some results that Joe Alfieri will be showing later in his talk about trying to partition ENT based on the correlation-based flux partitioning method for the vineyard site. And what I'm showing here are monthly estimates of ENT from this technique. That's the black triangles. So those are monthly values. The blue on the left-hand side is the T-SIB partitioning here. And the green here is the leaf area index, a monthly value of leaf area index derived from satellite-based data fusion approach around the tower estimates. And on the left here, on the bottom here is the actual daily LAI estimates. The red and green are of the two different vineyard sites. And this dashed line is the fraction green estimated based on some local observations. And in this first comparison here, there's a drop-off in the fraction green after harvest due to the plant senescence, the assumed plant senescence, and the change in LAI. What happens in the model results is that the model and the measurement E over T ratio, see, they agree there's a bit of a bias here, but then there's a major drop-off by the model, which is really drawn by this fraction green. If we assume that the green actually stays constant, there isn't a drop-off here, there actually is better agreement. Well, is this actually real? Well, if we take a look at the phenology photos, this is September. This is just a daily snapshot in September, October, November, and December. And what's interesting is that so after harvest, the vines are still fairly green. The cover crop actually starts growing back through milder temperatures and potentially a little bit of rainfall. As the vines start to senesce, the cover crop still maintains some vigor. And actually in December, when all the leaves, it's hard to see here, but all the leaves have fallen off the vine, but the cover crop is green and lush. So there's actually still a water source or ET source coming from the cover crop in between the vines, even though the vines, of course, are not transpiring at all. So actually the green fraction may be well maintained at near unity through the whole period of time. So moving on to UAV. So the idea here is that with UAV imagery, we can get a much more detailed depiction of what is going on in the vineyards. And here you have the north and south vineyards. This area, this is the southern vineyard, which is less mature than the northern vineyard. This is 8 to 10 years old, and the southern vineyard is around 5 years old. So they have different biomass conditions. And what we initially did was we ran the two-source model, extracted the source areas around the towers, and compared the model output. The results here are with the Priestley-Taylor approximation, and here it's with using the two temperatures derived from the higher resolution temperature data. And what you see is that they both do reasonably well. They actually, the temperature-based two-source model actually gives a bit tighter result in the estimated fluxes. When you, however, look at the map, you find that here on the left, the temperature-based two-source model actually shows some areas here where this is, again, the ratio of total transpiration LEC over the total flux. We actually see some areas here that show low ratios of these quantities in both the northern vineyard and the southern vineyard that aren't depicted or picked up in the Priestley-Taylor approximated approach. Now, where we did the validation, where the tower, what the towers were seeing was something in here. Well, this something in here was very similar for both models. So even though our validation was sort of giving us a confirmation, well, both models were giving us good answers for the area we were measuring, there's obviously areas where there's a discrepancy. And the thing to point out about this result is that when we're using spatial information, we really have to start comparing model outputs that compute spatially distributed products and evaluate their consistency, because what we see is that many of the modeling approaches that are developed with remote sensing focus on, okay, we compare it with these tower observations, they look good, so now we trust the model and it's going to give us reliable results all over. Well, certainly that's not necessarily the case. And so this just brings up a cautionary note that when we start to derive these ET maps, we really need to consider looking at variations in output by various models to give us a better understanding of where there is consistency and where there isn't, and understand why that happens. So here's some conclusions about the project that I described today. One is that treatment of canopy and soil exchange in terms of these aerodynamic resistances provides a more physically based approach using radiometric temperature for partial canopies. This, however, requires modeling both the wind and radiation inside the canopy airspace. These formulations then maybe require some modifications, particularly in strongly clumped and highly structured canopies. Additional theoretical and observational studies are needed to improve both soil and canopy resistance formulations. There's still, I think, a lot of work to be done in measuring and understanding what's going on inside of canopies. Measurements of ENT partitioned fluxes using multiple approaches are needed to validate models that produce these partitioned fluxes. And we need to look at various techniques of trying to scale those up as we look at mapping ENT over larger areas. We need to have more intercomparisons of ENT flux mapping using remote sensing models in order to really understand both their spatial variability, what is real in terms of that, and also get a better handle of the uncertainty that might exist in these different models. So with that, thank you.